I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're going to begin today with the economy and how the major presidential candidates say they would fix the mortgage meltdown crisis, which has led to a rash of foreclosures across the country. First, there's more bad news on the economy today. The Commerce Department reports that consumer spending came to a virtual standstill last month, increasing by an anemic 0.1%. That's the worst showing in almost a year and a half. The grim report is part of the fallout from the subprime mortgage crisis, which brings us to the presidential race. This week, all three main presidential candidates came out with their proposals to respond to the mortgage crisis. And joining us now to talk about them is business columnist David Leonhardt of the New York Times. And David, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Let's start with the presumptive Republican nominee, John McCain. Here he is speaking at the Orange County Hispanic Small Business Roundtable Tuesday in Los Angeles.
Any assistance must be temporary and must not reward people who are irresponsible at the expense of those who weren't. I will consider any and all proposals based on their cost and benefits. In this crisis, as in all I may face in the future, I will not allow dogma to override common sense.
Okay, David, a little bit of political rhetoric there. What's at the heart of McCain's proposal to respond to the mortgage crisis?
The main thing that McCain seems to be worried about is that we're going to overreact to this. And he's concerned in particular that we're going to end up bailing out homeowners who took on foolish mortgages and bailing out Wall Street. And I think there's a real argument that we should be worried about that. But that misses a larger issue, which is that this housing crisis has caused a broader financial crisis. And so there seems to be a need for some kind of government intervention to step in and get the system functioning well again.
Okay, so McCain then seems to be relatively laissez-faire relative to the Democrats. Let's listen to Senator Barack Obama, who offered his plan yesterday at Cooper Union in New York City, which includes giving the Federal Reserve more power to oversee security firms, not just commercial banks. Let's listen to him.
When all is said and done, losses will be in the many hundreds of billions. What was bad for Main Street turned out to be bad for Wall Street. Pain trickled up.
So what are the main components of Senator Obama's plan?
Senator Obama's plan, like Senator Clinton's plan, is in large part based on the idea that the government needs to intervene here, both to mitigate the pain and to make sure that the financial system doesn't freeze up. There are a number of steps that could be taken. They chiefly involve banks acknowledging that people aren't going to make their payments and reducing the size of mortgages for people. But banks are really reluctant to do that for understandable reasons. It involves them taking losses. The fact is, if they don't do it, they may take bigger losses because the homes will be foreclosed on and the banks will then get less money than they would otherwise if they could figure out a way to work out the mortgages. Senators Obama and Clinton both want to have the government play a role to essentially give the banks a push to make that happen.
Well, let's talk about Senator Clinton. She offered a plan that she said would focus on helping ordinary families. Here she is speaking earlier this week in Philadelphia.
Over the past week, we've seen unprecedented action to maintain confidence in our credit markets and head off a crisis for Wall Street banks. It's now time for equally aggressive action to help families avoid foreclosure.
So, David, what specifically would she do or does she propose to do to help families?
Many of hers and Obama's proposals are very similar. For example, they both want to amend the bankruptcy law. That will create a bit of a stick for banks. If banks know that homeowners could go into bankruptcy court and essentially have the court set the terms of their mortgage workout, the banks are more likely to be willing to do it voluntarily. I would say on the whole, though, that Senator Clinton does go further than Senator Obama. Clinton is more interested in things like freezing foreclosures for a certain amount of time and freezing interest rates even for a number of years going out.
Both these plans from Clinton and Obama would cost multi-billion dollars. But your own paper made this point that in terms of sheer dollars, the Democrats are offering much less than the current bailout by the Federal Reserve, which is lending as much as $400 billion to Wall Street firms. That's supported by McCain and the Bush administration. So in a sense, are Republicans actually offering more of a bailout than the Democrats?
I don't think so. I think the issue is that the Republicans, because they currently have the White House, have have to do more. Mm-hmm. And effectively, they have the Federal Reserve, meaning Ben Bernanke is a Republican, and he's the chairman of the Federal Reserve. So I don't think it's so much that Republicans want to go further than Democrats. I think it's more that the Republicans are the ones actually managing this crisis. But I think had the Democrats had the White House right now, they certainly would have been in favor of many of these steps and probably would have been in favor of more intervention than the Republicans have been in favor of.
And David, in a few seconds that we have left, what strikes you in general about how this crisis has played out or is playing out on the campaign trail?
I think it still affects a relatively small slice of the electorate. But I think the housing crisis, because it affects how people feel about the value of their own homes, which is incredibly important to most people's finances, has seeped into the larger issue of confidence and people's confidence in the economy. It's really striking. Some of the consumer sentiment numbers that came out this week showed that Americans were less optimistic about the economy's direction over the next 6 months than at any point since the oil embargo of 1973. And so I don't think it's so much that the specifics of the subprime mortgage crisis are affecting lots of voters. Most people are still perfectly on time with their mortgage payments. I think it seems to say something larger about the housing market and about the economy, and that's what has many people anxious right now.
Okay, David. Thanks so much for helping us today.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. That's business columnist David Leonhardt of the New York Times talking to us about the three main presidential candidates' plans on the economy. And now for some analysis of the various proposals to deal with the mortgage meltdown crisis. And to talk more broadly about nothing less than the state of U.S. capitalism, we're joined by Nariman Baravish. He's chief economist at Global Insight, an international economic forecasting firm based in Lexington, Massachusetts. And Nariman, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much.
Well, we just heard David Leonhardt detail what the presidential candidates would do. They range from John McCain's somewhat laissez-faire approach to a more robust government intervention favored by Senators Obama and Clinton. What's your take? What needs to happen here?
I think we've now moved beyond this notion that the markets can solve this problem on their own. I think it's quite clear that the markets are at least until very recently, were in panic mode. They're pushing down the price of a lot of these assets well below what any reasonable valuations would be. And that's the problem here, is that the markets are in fact, overreacting, if you will. So the challenge here is, if you will, to do good, if you can say it that way, without doing harm. And I think, you know, some of these proposals are a little better than others. I mean, for example, I think the proposal being put forward by Barney Frank and Chris Dodd, I think, is sort of more or less on the right track, whereas some of the proposals being made by Senator Clinton, I think, are going overboard. I think in the end they might do more damage than good.
Well, let's break that down. You've put a couple of ideas on the table, and before we get too far afield, for example, I mean, before we talk about Barney Frank and Chris Dodd, what goes too far, in your view, in the Clinton proposal?
I think if you start to freeze things like interest rates and foreclosures, you're just postponing the problem. And I think you add to the uncertainty about what are the prices of these things. What's the price, what's the reasonable valuation on a mortgage that is in trouble, if you will. If you freeze, then there's no way the market can figure out what that price is. And when you unfreeze, then the market could have a real fit.
I see. Now, you mentioned Barney Frank and Chris Dodd. They're proposing legislation that Congress, I guess, will begin to consider when they go back to work next week. And my understanding is they would basically allow the Federal Housing Administration to take over billions of dollars in mortgages heading toward foreclosure. Is that a good idea?
Right. Yeah. That's correct. I mean, the attractiveness of this proposal is that it does involve government involved. I mean, it does involve the government buying mortgages. But in effect, what it does is it puts a floor on those mortgages. And so in that sense, the government is, if you could say, making the market in some sense, creating an amount of certainty about what the prices of these things are. And that will help to calm the markets down. I think that's a much more productive way of approaching this problem than to try to freeze things.
Now, President Bush has called proposals like that, and I think this specific one, a bailout, which in his world is, you know, that's a bad thing. Is it a bailout?
Well, we're already past the discussion about bailouts, I think. You know, what we did with Bear Stearns is arguably a bailout, although nobody wants to call it that in the administration. But if we're going to bail out, in effect, securities companies, securities firms, you know, why aren't we bailing out the homeowners themselves? It's I think we're beyond this argument. It's a silly argument.
Mm. Let's talk about that and what the Bush administration is doing right now. Yesterday, the Wall Street Journal wrote this. It was a David Wessel column. He wrote, quote, "The past 10 days will be remembered as the time the U.S. government discarded a half century of rules to save American financial capitalism from collapse." And what he's referring to is this idea, which you alluded to earlier a moment ago, that the markets alone can't fix the problem. I mean, do you agree with his analysis? Does this represent a major shift away from what we've been dealing with for the last many years?
Absolutely. And the big shift is that rather than going through the commercial banks, the Citicorp and so forth, the Fed is now going directly to the investment banks, you know, the J.P. Morgans and the Morgan Stanleys. And that's a big, big shift. They haven't done that in a long, long time. And so from that perspective, going directly to them breaks that link that seemed to be not working very well between the commercial banks, who are very reluctant to lend now to the investment banks, and pumping money right into the investment banking system, and in effect preventing, we think, in the end, another big brokerage firm from going under. Mm. There was a lot of rumors right around the time of the Bear Stearns event, that some other large investment banks might go under. Now that risk of that is much, much less than it was before. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, if I have this correct, the Fed's decision has, as much as $400 billion to date have been lent to investment banks. And we're just seeing on the wires right now that the Federal Reserve will auction another $100 billion in April to cash-strapped banks. What's the broader implication of these old boundaries being erased, with the Fed going where it hasn't gone before?
I think it's a recognition that commercial banks are playing a smaller role in the economy, and these investment banks and capital markets are playing a bigger role. So therefore, the rules, the old rules of the Fed, that they had to go directly or indirectly through the commercial banks, I think just no longer apply, or they have to be rethought, if you will. The Fed did it under sort of emergency circumstances, but I think this was a long time coming because of the increasing role the capital markets are playing, say, relative to banks in the whole financial system.
Mm. And very quickly, Henry Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, suggested that now if the Fed is lending directly to these investment houses, then we need to have tougher regulations. That makes sense?
I agree. I mean, they have to be much more open. If they're going to borrow from the Fed what's called the discount window, then they have to be much more open about what's on their balance sheet.
Well, I want to pick up on that point when we come back, Nariman. We're going to take a very short break. Nariman Baravesh is chief economist for Global Insight. Our conversation about the economy continues in a moment. This is Here and Now. And we're back with Nariman Baravesh, chief economist for Global Insight, and we're talking about the current credit crisis and what the government should be doing and is doing. And Nariman, let me pick up with the case of Bear Stearns, the near collapse of the Bear Stearns investment firm. I'd be grateful if you could explain what precisely the government did to save Bear Stearns and why it felt that it was so important.
Well, I think that there are a couple of things to be said. The first is that Bear Stearns was out of money. It couldn't cover a lot of its losses. And the worry was that this sort of illiquidity, if you will, lack of funds, would turn into a major problem in terms of insolvency. As its stock price was collapsing, its assets were much less valuable than its liabilities. That's what's referred to as an insolvency. So the issue was to protect this very large brokerage firm from going bankrupt, basically. So what they did was they worked out a deal where another fairly sound financial institution, J.P. Morgan, would buy Bear Stearns, but then they guaranteed, if you will, through loans and so forth, a lot of the liabilities, if you will, that J.P. Morgan was going to take on. So they provided that sort of backup, if you will, to J.P. Morgan, so that it could take on this this new entity, if you will, absorb it without getting pulled down by all the problems at Bear Stearns.
I see. And, of course, the risk is if Bear Stearns goes down, that could create a perception of a real crisis that could then infect, essentially, other investment houses, and you could have a real sort of spiraling crisis, correct?
Exactly. And there are two parts to that. One is, in fact, that if they hadn't done something about Bear Stearns, there would have been a full-blown financial panic, which would have pulled down the valuations for all the brokerage houses, even the very sound ones. You don't want that to happen. But secondly, by allowing the investment banks to borrow from the Federal Reserve, what the Fed did was pump liquidity into the investment banks directly, and in that sense allowed them some breathing space to deal with this subprime mess that they've got on their hands.
Mm. So what's the risk to the American taxpayer by allowing these guarantees, essentially by being the creditor of last resort almost? What's the risk to the American taxpayer?
I think you have to understand the role of the Fed and the Treasury here to answer that question. The Federal Reserve earns a lot on its portfolio, which it then turns over to the Treasury. So it pays a tax, but gives revenues, if you will, to the Treasury. If, by virtue of doing what it did with Bear Stearns and lending all this money to investment banks, it actually loses money on its portfolio, on its earnings, if you will, on all those assets that it's holding, then it will, at a minimum, turn less over to the Treasury and may actually have to get some money from the Treasury if things go really bad. Now, we're nowhere near that, but that's a sort of a potential scenario. So in the end, if that does happen, it's the U.S. taxpayer that's going to be left holding the bag.
Interesting. Paul Krugman of the New York Times has been writing about this crisis, and I want to sort of talk to you a little bit about sort of how we got here. And Krugman has been arguing that one of the lessons of the Great Depression was that banks had to be regulated and operate within certain rules, and that the current crisis is largely a result of discarding those rules and allowing a sort of second financial industry to develop that's relatively unhindered by regulation. Is that fair? And are we going to, do we need to learn that lesson all over again?
I wouldn't go so far as Paul Krugman, in the sense that I think there's a big danger here of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, namely that all this financial innovation, the rise of capital markets, we'll look back after this crisis is over and we'll say net, it was a good thing. However, there clearly are problems. And to me, the biggest single problem about this crisis is lack of transparency. In other words, the good news was all these structured loans, all these collateralized debt was sold, it was divested, it went into the financial system. Bad news is we don't know where it ended up. And part of the panic here is that uncertainty about where is this stuff? Where's the toxic waste that we don't know about? And I think that disclosure is probably what has to change in a big way. Greater disclosure in the end in the securities industry is what's needed here.
And is that what Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson has suggested when he talks about, now that the Fed is lending directly to these investment houses, they probably need to be subjected to more federal regulation? I mean, is that sort of what's on top of his mind?
I think so. I would say that's a minimum. I think we need reporting standards that are much tighter, much, much more open than we've had so far in the securities industry. In the end, I think that's what's necessary. Markets work best when the information is out there, it's open, people can behave accordingly. And what we've had is a complete breakdown in the information flow.
Interesting. Now, the problems that we're talking about here are all traced, obviously, to housing. Are there signs that the same thing is happening elsewhere around the world? In other words, is this a global issue now?
I think a very large part of the housing boom in the U.S. had global elements in the sense that if you look at interest rates, long-term interest rates, mortgage rates in a lot of industrialized and even some emerging markets, they've been falling for the last 20, 25 years. And the relevance of that is it has made mortgages and housing much more affordable to a lot more people. And so we have seen housing booms in a lot of countries, and some of them, like the UK, Ireland, Spain, these housing booms have even been more dramatic than in the US. I mean, for example, house price in the last 10 years went up 200% in the UK. They only went up 100% in the US. This is average for the nation. So in some sense, the housing bubbles are even bigger overseas, in some countries at least, than in the U.S.
And have they been subjected to the same kind of sort of subprime deals that could cause the same kind of collapse that we've seen here?
The answer, the sort of one-word answer is no, in the sense that in the U.K. and Spain, they have not had the kind of subprime lending that you've had in the U.S. However, even in those countries, we're starting to see house prices come down just by virtue of the fact that they got way out of line, if you will, with incomes, with rents and so on. So they're coming down. I suspect they will not have the same kind of crisis that we're having here in the U.S. because they didn't have the subprime problems.
All right. Well, Nariman Baravesh, thanks so much for helping us sort a lot of this out. We appreciate it. Complicated subject. We appreciate your insights.
My pleasure.
That's Nariman Baravesh. He's chief economist for Global Insight in Lexington, Massachusetts. Monday on Here and Now, with fresh turmoil in Iraq and the economy at home in trouble, Congress goes back to work. We'll have a preview of this election year season. That's Monday. And still ahead today, if you think the U.S. economy is in tough shape, consider Zimbabwe, where inflation is running at 100,000%. We'll have a preview of tomorrow's presidential elections. It's Here and Now. If you think the U.S. economy is in tough shape, consider Zimbabwe, where inflation is running at 100,000%. That means a loaf of bread cost 25 million hyperinflated Zimbabwe dollars. That's worth just 62 American cents, but it's more than the average teacher makes in a week in that southern African country. That's the backdrop for national elections scheduled for tomorrow. The economic crisis represents a major challenge to Robert Mugabe, who is fighting to prolong his 28-year presidency. Many in Zimbabwe and around the world say it's long past time for Mugabe to go. Zan Smiley is Middle East and Africa editor for The Economist magazine. He's just returned from Zimbabwe and joins us from London. And Zan, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, not long ago, Zimbabwe was one of the African success stories. Now it's an economic basket case. Give us a sense of what you saw when you were down there. How bad is it?
It's strange, really. I mean, if you're in the capital, Harare, people are bustling along, and the shops, of course, are extremely empty. And if you go into the countryside, where most of the people live, then you do get more of a sense of desolation. Farm after farm covered in weeds, very few cattle, a sort of sense of rural dissolution, if you like. And, of course, even those in the capital and the few big towns who are going about their business find it incredibly difficult to know how to pay for things because prices have been doubling, I think, about every 2 weeks.
So that's the backdrop for the elections. Robert Mugabe has held on to power for 28 years, once known as an African liberation hero who freed his country from colonial rule. I gather he still has a good deal of support there, but what are the prospects? How's he viewed now?
It's very difficult to gauge his support. There was an election in 2005, a parliamentary one, and a presidential one in 2002. I think a lot of people's support was confined to the rural areas, the landless poor, and they, for quite a few years, were interested and even excited by his promises of, as it were, handing over the land, because a disproportionate amount of the good land was in the hands of a small number of white farmers. But 3 years on, and this actually very brutal redistribution of land, that process started about 7 years ago, and of course most of the landless poor have not been the ones who have benefited. Many of the ones who have benefited have been Mr. Mugabe himself and his friends and so forth. And in addition to that, as the economy has spiraled down, in the rural areas people find it very difficult to get basic food, maize, cooking oil, sugar, salt. All these sort of things are in sorely lacking. You know, what appeal Mugabe had a few years ago has begun to shrink.
Zan, tell me who Mugabe's opponents are tomorrow. I understand one of them comes from within his own party, which represents a rather unprecedented challenge to him.
Yes, I mean, I think that is one of the big differences this time round. His main challenger is a tough, dogged trade unionist called Morgan Tsvangirai. He's been against Mugabe openly for about 9 years. And indeed, in the last presidential election, which was sort of heavily tilted against him, he still won, I think it was about 44%. Mugabe got about 54%, something like that. But the other factor, which is very new, is that there is a challenger from within Mugabe's ruling ZANU-PF party called Simba Makoni, who's widely respected. He was finance minister. He seems a decent guy. He hasn't really, it seems, built up a mass following. He just didn't have enough time for that. But he has split the party wide open. And he's made it slightly more difficult, I think, for Mugabe to get the sort of rigging machinery in place, because some of these people alongside the new challenger, Simba Makoni, are people who know how it was done and may have even been part of it before.
Well, so I wanted to ask you about that, because we know from past experience that Mugabe and his ZANU-PF party have used corruption, even thuggery, to hold on to power. You referenced sort of rigging machinery. I've read recently that more ballots have been printed than there are registered voters. So
a huge number of tricks that can be brought into play. I mean, the Registrar General, who is in charge of the roll, is a Mugabe man. And there's all sorts of flaws. It's out of date. There are thousands of dead people. Soldiers can vote by postal voting en bloc. The polling stations in the towns where the opposition is much stronger may not give people enough time to vote. And, of course, there is sort of basic intimidation, which is in the countryside, which I've mentioned before, is where most people live. The heads of the police, the army, and the prisons have all stated flatly that they would never allow Mugabe to lose. So, you know, there is a sort of, there's still an atmosphere of intimidation and trickery, but because of the new challenger within the party, because patronage has become more difficult for Mugabe to dispense, because there are less goodies to chuck around, and because the old promises of land for the landless and so forth don't ring so true, there is a slightly better chance, in fact a distinctly better chance, that the opposition may make inroads.
What about international monitors? Is anyone going to be monitoring these elections?
Mugabe has banned all independent monitors from the United States and from Europe, but he has asked governments of such countries as Iran, Russia, Venezuela, so-called anti-imperialist ones, to come along. But really the key one, I think, is known as SADC, which stands for Southern African Development Community, which is a group of 15 countries in Southern Africa led by South Africa. And in the past, they have given a sort of favorable verdict even, you know, before the election is over. But there is a small hope that this time they may feel that Mugabe really is a sort of impediment to the whole of Southern Africa, because, of course, you know, the decline of the economy hurts all the surrounding countries.
Tomorrow's elections have a lot to say about Mugabe's personal future and, of course, the future of Zimbabwe, but it sounds like there's something at stake for Africa, or at least Southern Africa as a whole, in this election.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, South Africa is overwhelmingly the key economic sort of engine of actually the whole of sub-Saharan Africa now. Has over half the sub-Saharan Africa's GDP. But Zimbabwe was a very vital, lively economy 20 years ago, and the fact that it has, you know, virtually collapsed is very, very bad for the neighbors. Just one more point I should make, which is, it sounds a bit technical, but it's very important. It is supposed to be a two-round election, and a winner can only win in the first round if he gets 50% plus one vote. And undoubtedly, Mr. Mugabe would be hoping that he could pull that off. But I think even if he does a lot of rigging, it may be very, very difficult for him to win outright first time round. And then you're into a playoff, a runoff between the two leading candidates.
Well, Zan Smiley, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Zan Smiley. He's Middle East and Africa editor for The Economist, talking about national elections scheduled for tomorrow in Zimbabwe. And before we go today, we'll review some of the films that have been made about the war in Iraq, including the newest one out today. Stay with us. You're listening to Here and Now. The cities of Phoenix, San Francisco, Atlanta, and Chicago, among others, will go dark tomorrow night for 1 hour. At least that's the plan. From 8 to 9 p.m., the lights will be turned off in municipal buildings and, in theory, in a lot of private homes as well. It's all part of Earth Hour, an international awareness campaign run by the conservation group the World Wildlife Fund. Leslie Ahn is spokeswoman for the World Wildlife Fund and joins us from San Francisco. And Leslie, tell us what 1 hour of relative darkness tomorrow night will accomplish in these cities.
Well, the whole idea here is to give people an opportunity to express their concern about climate change and their willingness to commit to make changes in their own lives that will help bring about a reduction in emissions. As you know, the United States is the largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world, yet we don't have a coherent national climate change policy. Most of that work is being done at the state and the local level.
So what's the plan for Earth Hour? I understand some 35 cities across the U.S. are participating. What exactly are you expecting them to do?
What we're expecting these cities to do, to varying degrees, is to turn off their lights. So let's imagine the city of Chicago. If you've ever flown in over the lake and you've seen all the high-rises along Lakeshore Drive, including the Sears Tower, the John Hancock Building, all those iconic buildings, those lights on those buildings are going to dim. And now, I want to be really clear about something. We want this to be a safe event, so we're not turning off the, you know, the lights at the very tops of the buildings that make sure airplanes steer clear. The airports are going to stay lit. You know, hospitals are going to stay lit. Street lighting that's essential to the safety of all these cities are going to stay lit. But what we're turning off is the non-essential lighting. I don't know if you've ever driven through a city. I think most of us have and looked up and seen all these big skyscrapers in the middle of the night, and they're all brightly lit, and we thought, gee, why do they have all those lights on? Well, this is an opportunity to turn off the lights.
Mm. And the cities have agreed to do this.
Yeah, that was one of our prerequisites for Earth Hour. We had to have an engaged city. So we actually invited more than 35 cities around the United States to participate. And we heard back from some. Some said, we think it's a great idea, but we just don't think we can pull it off in time. Chicago was the first city to say yes. And then at the very last hour, we had involvement from also Atlanta and Phoenix and San Francisco. But since then, a lot of cities have said, hey, we think this is really neat. We'd like to do it too. So we now have on board Honolulu, Denver, Miami, Charlotte, St. Louis. Those are the big names. We have also a lot of smaller cities and communities.
Hmm. Well, 8 p.m., that's a busy time on a Saturday night. Theaters are beginning, shows, movies. I mean, are you making suggestions about what people should be doing instead with the lights off?
Yeah, if you go to our website, earthhour.org, we have all sorts of nifty ideas for people to do, change out their light bulbs from the old-fashioned to the energy-efficient CFLs. But what we found is, you know, people are coming to us with the great ideas. So there's the yoga studio in Michigan, and they're going to have yoga in the dark. Here in San Francisco, they're going to be leading, the local parks department is going to be holding a camp out under the stars. In Chicago, there's even a couple that's going to get married and have their wedding reception in the dark. So, well, with candlelight, I should say. But, you know, people have all sorts of fantastic ideas for what they want to do.
Now, do you have any idea how much electricity is actually going to be saved, for example, in a city in Chicago for 1 hour? Or is that really not the point here? Is this more a symbolic idea to just suggest to people that, hey, you can switch the lights off and save energy anytime?
That's exactly right. This is really a symbolic event. I mean, we're hoping that in some of our cities we'll get a sense of how much energy was saved, but that's really more a measure of the participation versus the actual energy savings. We think the real energy savings is going to come after the event, okay? So Earth Hour is the start of something. We're asking people to do something pretty simple. I mean, everybody knows how to turn off their lights. That really sends a very strong message that collectively we can achieve something pretty big.
Hmm. Leslie Ahn is a spokeswoman for the World Wildlife Fund, talking about the campaign for cities, homes, and businesses to turn off their lights for an hour tomorrow night. And Leslie Ahn, I've got to ask you one more question. Are you going to be Leslie off for that hour?
It feels like, you know, I've been set. I never knew my whole life was a setup for this job.
That's great. Thanks, Leslie.
Who knew? Thank you so much.
For more information about Earth Hour, go to our website, here-now.org. Coming up, Iraq at the movies. You're listening to Here and Now. The new film Stop Loss opens in theaters across the country today. In the movie, Ryan Phillippe plays a soldier just home from a strenuous tour of duty in Iraq. When he reports for his discharge, he gets some unexpected and unwelcome news.
You leave on the 22nd, shipping back to Iraq. Subsection 12305, Title 10, by the authority of the president. You've been stop lost.
Stop loss is the military's policy of ensuring that it has enough troops to maintain the war effort. In the movie, Brandon struggles with a difficult decision, whether to report back for duty or to go AWOL. Stop loss is the latest of several movies to tackle the war in Iraq, and if recent history is any guide, it might have difficulty finding an audience. Here to talk about how Hollywood has been approaching the Iraq war is Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. And Ty, welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, you've seen Stop Loss. Give us your 20-second review. How did you like it?
Well, like a lot of the films that have come out about the U.S. soldiers in Iraq, it's earnest, it's impassioned, it's outraged, and it tries to do a little too much. And it tries to fit, you know, a real story, the issue of soldiers being returned to Iraq under the stop-loss loophole. It tries to fit it into a Hollywood box that doesn't always fit. For instance, the hero, he wants to, you know, not be stop-loss. He doesn't want to go back to Iraq, and he wants to contact his senator. He could pick up the phone and call him, but no. The movie wants to be a road movie. He wants to take you across modern America, so he doesn't pick up the phone. He gets in a car with his best friend's girlfriend, and they take off across America. Things like that don't quite jibe.
Let's talk about another Iraq war movie, one that I've seen and actually thought was pretty powerful. It's called In the Valley of Elah. It stars Tommy Lee Jones and Susan Sarandon. Tommy Lee Jones received an Oscar nomination for his role. He played a father trying to find out what happened to his murdered son who served in Iraq. And let's listen to a clip. Here he is trying to convince a police officer, played by Charlize Theron, to get involved in the investigation.
Hey, I know you're busy, but all I need you to do is make one phone call to his bank and find out if he's made any withdrawals or used his credit card in the last week.
Retired cop or just watched a lot of TV?
Military police retired.
Then you should know. Army has jurisdiction over its own personnel. I'm sorry. I hope you find your son.
Hey, I don't know what you think your job is, but if it's anything like mine was, it's to roll up drunks, twiddle your thumbs, not ask too many questions. But my son has spent the last 18 months bringing democracy to a shithole and serving his country. He deserves better than this.
Ty, In the Valley of Elah, it made less than $7 million at the box office, which is very little for a big Hollywood production. Is that consistent with how these movies about Iraq have done?
Very consistent, especially the dramas. The documentaries are a whole other issue. The dramas aren't getting distributed, for one thing. There are a number of movies that have... for better or for worse, aren't reaching theaters. And when they do reach theaters, audiences really aren't turning out to see them. And the Valley of Elah has put the best foot forward in that you've got real stars. You've got, you know, Tommy Lee Jones. You've got a director, Paul Haggis, and a writer who, you know, won an Oscar for Crash. I mean, the stars aligned for that film. I think that was the best shot that these kind of movies have. But people don't want to engage.
Mm. Here's another example. And speaking of star power, Lions for Lambs had Robert Redford as an idealistic college professor, Tom Cruise as a senator, Meryl Streep as a journalist. Let's listen to a scene with Meryl Streep and Tom Cruise from Lions for Lambs.
You're about to implement another new strategy, regardless of the human cost or the financial cost, because you predict
we thought
that
deeply
maybe
about the human cost when we were planning this strategy.
What were your estimates exactly?
What I can say is that this strategy has patience and determination at its core. It ensures that it puts our fighting men in spots where they can face, fight, and kill the enemy, so that we can then go about rebuilding that country.
So that's Tom Cruise and Meryl Streep in a scene from Lions for Lambs, which flopped at the box office. Another movie, Ty, that didn't do well, Rendition. There was the Samuel Jackson movie Home of the Brave, which I don't think it even opened in theaters, for example, here in Boston.
No, it didn't. That was a movie that was absolutely dropped by its distributor, as was Grace is Gone, which is more of a home front drama with John Cusack. When they put it out there to see maybe if Cusack might get an Oscar nomination, that didn't happen, so it was, for all intents and purposes, let go.
So is Iraq the problem, the subject the problem, or is it the way these films are approaching the subject?
Well, ironically, the Iraq War has resulted in some of the best documentary filmmaking, you know, we've seen in ages. I mean, no end in sight, the war tapes, why we fight, Gunnar Palace, the Michael Moore movie, of course, Fahrenheit 9/11, which was a huge success. But it's not translating into dramatic terms. Part of the problem is that filmmakers are bringing their passion, their outrage to bear, and then trying to fit it into, if not entertaining shape, believable narrative shape, and it doesn't always work. Another problem is that we just may not be ready as moviegoers to deal with these issues in a dramatic form. During the Vietnam War, there were no Vietnam War movies made besides John Wayne and the Green Berets, but the ones that followed the war,
Deer Hunter, Apocalypse Now,
exactly. All those films were able to deal with the conflict in a way that audiences were ready to engage.
Do you think maybe if and when this conflict in Iraq ends, maybe years after that, the audience will be ready to take on the subject?
I think so, and I also don't know. I wonder if this is a different kind of war because of the internet, because of the nature of reporting today, where really the films that are addressing it most directly and provocatively are documentaries. The narrative films, the Hollywood response, no matter how well-intentioned, always feels a little forced, always feels a little fake. It's like the end of In the Valley of Elah, which I thought was a wonderful movie, but when it makes that overt statement at the end, when Tommy Lee Jones hangs the flag upside down, that's when I felt let down, as if the film had finally sort of shown its cards and was pushing you too hard.
Even the HBO series Over There, which was produced by Stephen Bochco, which was about soldiers serving today and almost in real time in Iraq, that failed. And I was reading a quote from Bochco the other day in the papers, and he said that with hindsight, it's clear that Americans are bombarded every day by real images of the war on a daily basis, and that's the last thing they want to see when they go to the theater, which is consistent with what you said.
Because it's a complicated war, we don't feel that we're necessarily doing the right thing. People want to avoid it. It's a Gordian knot. It's something that is unpleasant to confront, which is, of course, one reason we should be confronting it, but it's not something that the average person wants to deal with, especially when they paid $10.50 and, you know, are sitting down with popcorn.
Well, you were mentioning the documentaries that have done well. I want to play a clip from No End in Sight. This was a documentary that looked at the turmoil that followed the American invasion of Iraq. It interspersed footage with commentary, and in this scene, we see Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld at a press briefing talking about the looting in Iraq. Let's listen.
The images you are seeing on television, you are seeing over and over and over, and it's the same picture of some person walking out of some building with a vase.
I think that was probably the day that we lost the Iraqis.
And you think, my goodness, were there that many vases? is it possible that there were that many vases in the whole country?
So that was former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld from the documentary No End in Sight. Ty, this is a documentary that did well. When we say that a documentary film did well, what are we talking about in terms of number of people that go and see it?
Well, No End in Sight, I think, grossed $1.8 million. I think that's the figure, which has been pointed out. That's, you know, what Spider-Man 3 does in, like, a handful of movie theaters over its opening weekend.
But good for a documentary. Right?
Very, very good for a documentary. I mean, the Michael Moore film, Fahrenheit 9/11, is, you know, has grossed over $200 million worldwide, but that's completely unique. If it doesn't have Michael Moore or Marching Penguins, it really isn't going to roll up the grosses. Nevertheless, this is where I think the best filmmaking and really the most influential filmmaking, I think, in the long run is happening. I was lucky to see a couple of weeks ago Errol Morris's new documentary, Standard Operating Procedure, about Abu Ghraib, in which he creates an absolutely scorching document on the chain of command and what this war does to people, especially the low echelon soldiers.
Fascinating. And when can we expect to see that in theaters?
That, I think, is coming out in a couple of months.
Well, Ty Burr, thanks for coming in.
Sure, thanks.
Appreciate it. That's Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr.